Hey, you're the one looking up stuff on ChatGPT over there.
I asked very specifically what questions to ask Mike Florio of ProFootballTalk.com on a Cleveland Sports Talk radio show.
Hey, I think we have an idea of it right now, and he joins us on the fan hotline from Pro Football Talk and NBC Sports. Also has ebooks out right now that you can find on Amazon, Father of Mine and Son of Mine. You know, he's an author and a writer. And I believe you are now, wait a minute, did you pass the bar, Mike? I'm sorry, are you a lawyer?
Yeah, I practiced for 18 years. I passed the bar twice, once in Pennsylvania and once in West Virginia.
I'll be dipped. Okay, I thought so, but I'm like, because there's a lot of guys who used to be like lawyers.
Congratulations on all your success.
And then they're writers, and I'm like, well, okay, which ones are which? So
that was not one of the ChatGPT questions that Ken just asked.
With what's going on with Quinshon Judkins here, I mean, let's go from a legal standpoint first. What's facing this Browns running back? And then we'll go to an NFL standpoint if we can.
Well, misdemeanor, domestic battery. The police report was released yesterday. Closed fist punch to the mouth chin area of a former, or maybe more on again, off again, girlfriend. She waited a few days to decide to make the report, which is understandable under the circumstances. Look, I don't know what's true and what's not true, but it would be understandable that somebody wouldn't want to immediately call 911 and derail someone's career. Maybe she wanted to try to work through it. Maybe it just took her time. She told the police. She talked to friends and family about it, decided to make the report. She still had visible bruising. She had pictures from the day after the incident where the bruising was even more evident, according to the police report. So that's what he faces under Florida law, misdemeanor, domestic battery. But the separate issue is what the NFL will do about it. And one thing we've learned over the past 11 years, all the way back to the Ray Rice case, the NFL does not look kindly on allegations of players engaged in any form or fashion of domestic violence.
Well, Mike, we clearly know that optics are a big deal in the NFL. It stinks that we have to talk about the gravity of things like domestic violence, but then try to fashion it into a sports talk discussion about how many games maybe a player is suspended or whether it's the commissioner's exemplus. With that said, you know, I saw the headline on the New York Post this morning about this case and the grisly details involved in the police report. And that's when the NFL tends to really react to these things, no?
It's all a PR tool. And for most employers, and I'm not saying whether this is right or wrong, let's just put this in the proper context. For most employers in the United States of America, anything you do away from work does not matter to your employment relationship, as long as you can show up for work. And when I used to practice law, I would advise companies from time to time on the things that were okay and not okay to consider when deciding whether or not to keep someone. And for the NFL, that's gone out the window because there's collective bargaining, and the union and the league have agreed that for certain things, the personal conduct policy comes into play, even if it is completely unrelated to anything the player ever does at work. He's still going to be held responsible. Think about it. He's not working off season. He's not even signed to a contract yet. He's subject to this policy. That's the way the NFL does it. And it's all a product of PR because of the outcry from the fans, from the customers. If you have guys who are doing things they shouldn't be doing and the NFL imposes no punishment upon them, that's where it all comes from. It's all PR driven. It's case by case. But one thing we've seen, when domestic violence is involved, the NFL is far more likely to take action and maybe swift action, including putting him on paid leave right after he signs his contract.
So regardless of the legal outcome of this, because, you know, last year this went on with Mike Hall, who was another second round draft pick of the Browns. Legally, there wasn't very much of it, but he was still suspended for a time. And it basically, with the injury at the end of the season, became a lost season. Am I to assume as much with Quinshon Judkins here with this Browns football team?
Well, here's the timeline with Mike Hall. The incident happened on August 12. He was arrested on August 13. By the 26th, he was placed on paid leave. And when you're placed on paid leave, you stay on paid leave until the case is resolved and until the subsequent NFL personal conduct policy case is resolved. So that creates a very real incentive for the player to resolve the criminal case ASAP and then pivot around and take whatever punishment the NFL proposes and get back on the field. And that's what happened with Hall. He pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct. He ended up being suspended, I think, 5 games.
Mm-hmm.
And he got credit for the 4 that he missed while he was on paid leave. So there is strategically a reason to get this done the moment you're put on paid leave. Because if you just let the legal system play out while you're on paid leave, you may miss the whole season. Because unless you have an incentive to try to get your case wrapped up, and being on paid leave gives you that incentive, yeah, this thing could just linger and linger and linger. So that's how it could go for Judkins. We don't know what the NFL is going to do. They'll do their own investigation. They'll make a decision on whether or not they're going to put him on paid leave. They won't necessarily even announce that they're not doing it. But if they do it, he'll be gone, and he'll be back once that case is resolved, and presumably once he works out some sort of a deal with the NFL on whatever his punishment will be under the personal conduct policy.
Boy, you said something interesting there about the incentive structure that could be there for the player in these situations to plead, to get something over with sooner. Do prosecutors tend to use that as leverage when they have high-profile cases such as this?
Prosecutors use anything that they have. And if there's a way to get Quinshon Judkins to plead guilty to something and wrap up the case and move on, and they know he's going to receive a punishment within the confines of his employment, yeah, that becomes part of what is negotiated. Now, again, Mike Hall pleaded guilty at the end of the day to disorderly conduct, and he allegedly put a gun to his girlfriend / fiance's head. So, you know, you may get some cooperation if you're willing to face the music and get this done quickly. But I think the prosecutors, if you're going to be fair, you recognize this guy's going to have a hell of a lot greater consequence within the confines of his employment than he's going to have as a first-time offender under the legal system.
Mike Florio joining us from Pro Football Talk and NBC Sports. What happens with the contract negotiation now? He's one of many, many, many second-rounders who haven't signed yet. They wanted guaranteed money, and now this is a major wrench thrown in here, is it not?
Yeah, and here's the broader look at what's going on in round two. You've never had fully guaranteed contracts in the second round of the draft. This year, the Texans stepped out of line and gave Jaden Higgins a fully guaranteed contract at the second pick in round two. That bracketed the Browns and forced them to do a fully guaranteed contract with Carson Schwechinger, the first pick in round two. Everyone after that, and the next guy up is Nick Emmanuel of the Seahawks, then Judkins, the fourth pick in round two. It isn't just all of them trying to get fully guaranteed contracts. There's a percentage that each guy gets fully guaranteed, and when you jack the top two all the way up to 100, the rest of them are going to see an increase, and you really don't know what the right increase is until the guys in front of you do their deals. There's a thought around the league that Judkins is going to be the one to take less than 100 because of this arrest, and that's going to set the ceiling for the fifth guy in round two, which sets the ceiling for the sixth guy in round two, and they're just going to fall like dominoes all the way down to the bottom of the round. By the bottom of the round last year, it was like 52% of the deal was fully guaranteed. So again, these guys aren't going to get 100% guarantee. It's just the fact that the top two got 100%. It screws up everything else. But there's a belief that Judkins is going to be the one to get the deal done because of what happened. And then the agents will just blame it on Judkins as they cave at lower and lower percentages as we get deeper and deeper into the round.
Mike Florio, you've done terrific work along with Pablo Torre on the collusion case that is now starting to ruffle some feathers even more so around the NFL, and in particular with the players' union, where it doesn't seem like everybody was kept apprised of the collusion case. And for those that don't know, it all really starts with the guaranteed contract that Jimmy Haslam and the Browns gave to Deshaun Watson, and how that was greeted by owners around the league. So what's the latest development with all this, in particular the CBA, players' union?
And really, it comes from the league. It all started with the league because they were able to twice fend off efforts by the NFL Players Association to make fully guaranteed contracts for all players part of the collective bargaining agreement. So 2011, 2020, the NFL pushed back on that. When the Browns turn around and give Deshaun Watson 5-year fully guaranteed, the NFL's like, oh, wait a minute. Let's not give these guys piecemeal what we've been able to collectively prevent them from getting. That's basically what happened. The league in this collusion grievance that was hidden from everyone. The league was caught with their hand in the cookie jar, telling teams, urging teams to collude when it comes to the amount of guarantees. And the Watson deal sparked it. And then the teams held the rope as to the next quarterback contracts, Kyler Murray, Russell Wilson, Lamar Jackson, no fully guaranteed contracts for any of them. So where it stands now, the NFLPA has been shamed into filing an appeal of this ruling, which was hidden for 5 months. So there will be an appeal. I don't know that it goes forward. It's possible the NFLPA gives up its appeal because the NFL wants more than $12 million in reimbursement for attorney's fees, which I think is a very weak argument under the CBA, but that becomes cover for the NFLPA to just move on from this thing. And then meanwhile, what happened is once ESPN, after a few weeks of no one doing anything by way of advancing the story that Pablo and I lit the fuse on, after some ESPN reporting last week, it came out that Executive Director Lloyd Howell has an obvious conflict of interest. He's a paid part-time consultant with a private equity fund that has been approved to buy minority interest in NFL teams. I mean, it's as blatant as you can get. And now the NFLPA kind of circling the wagons around Howell, and some think they're just trying to kick the can to when training camp opens. And we all have bright, shiny objects every single day that distract us from this, and they can go forward with the Lloyd Howell. But we'll see. We'll see. There's a lot more to it. And Pablo's done a great job, and we've kind of both encouraged each other and challenged each other to advance the story. And it's hard to do when no one cares about it. And I thought it was funny over the weekend. When the NFLPA put out a very self-serving statement to support Lloyd Howell, all these reporters who had ignored the story from the get-go are quoting that statement. It's like, you guys don't even know what the hell's going on. And you're just putting that statement out there. You've been actively ignoring the story, but people are paying attention, and one thing I've realized is the fans really care about it. They just understand there's something wrong about everything that's going on, and even if it doesn't directly affect what we see on the football field, if the stuff behind the curtain isn't right, if there isn't a right balance there between league and players, it can create all sorts of weird outcomes, and it's just good to see that so many fans give a crap about something that so many reporters have been burying their head in the sands over.
Yeah, but Mike, if there is no recourse here, despite what the findings were, the management council and even owners openly saying that there was basically collusion here. With all that going on, what's the recourse if the judge didn't really punish the NFL? And what's to stop the NFL from continuing to go about its business in this manner and colluding?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens if this appeal goes forward, because it goes to a three-judge panel. And the way I read the CBA, I don't think the arbitrator's decision gets a whole lot of deference. And I don't want to get too deep into the legal weeds, but a lot of times when you take a case up on appeal, you're stuck with some of the decisions made by the judge who handled the case below. I don't think the three-judge panel on appeal is going to be bound by anything. So if there's a 2-1 ruling that the arbitrator got it wrong when he ignored and basically dismissed strong circumstantial evidence of actual collusion, because the arbitrator found, because he had to find, the league urged the teams to collude. He found that there was no evidence of actual collusion because he had an explanation for every piece of circumstantial evidence that was damning to the NFL's position. If two of these three judges that at the next level say, nah, you know what, we don't expect them to admit it. And look, one of the things I learned in my law practice, I represented employees who were fired from their jobs. And you file a wrongful discharge case, and you're going to have a parade of witnesses saying, no, we didn't consider that factor we weren't supposed to consider. So you have to prove that they did through circumstantial evidence. I think that the NFLPA has the circumstantial evidence. So there could be still an adverse ruling for the NFL, a possibly crippling billion-dollar damages award for the NFLPA. That's still possible. We'll see how zealous the NFLPA is. As I said earlier, they were shamed into filing the appeal. Will they zealously push this? Will they try to win it? That's why people are watching this. There's this weird sense that the NFL and the NFLPA, the NFLPA non-player leadership, that they're kind of in bed together, and these conflicts of interest, or the one very specific one Lloyd Howell has, is what's fueling this idea that something's going on here. And that's why I think fans care. Their spider sense is telling them, based upon the reporting that's been done that's really tackled this issue, something's going on. And And that's the biggest problem for both the union and the league. It just feels like something's going on.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk. He's on the Fan Hotline. Find him on Twitter. Find him on X. Find him on everything at Pro Football Talk. He's the author of two ebooks out right now.
Got a new one coming too.
Oh, you got a new one.
August 19th.
Well, what's the new one? What's the new one?
It's called Big Shield, and it is a fictional tale of how gambling, the mob, and professional football, but not the NFL, wink, wink, so I don't get sued for copyright infringement, can come together and create chaos. Because I've been very concerned about what legalized gambling can do as it relates to scandals in the NFL if the NFL isn't careful. And the main area I'm concerned about is how inside information can be misused by players. I don't think the NFL is nearly as concerned about what can happen. So this story is about a third-string quarterback who misuses inside information, funnels it to the mob, before games, and more importantly, during games, to give the mob an inside track on what they need to know to win their bets. And it just kind of goes from there.
And that's on Amazon as well, August 19th.
It'll be available on Amazon. You can pre-order it now. 99 cents for the ebook, which is so freaking stupid of me. I almost said the other word, and thankfully I didn't. But it's so freaking stupid of me to sell them for 99 cents. It's a great deal, and you can get the print version for $14.99. Comes out August 19th.
Glorious. Absolutely glorious. Mike, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, guys.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, all over social media, all over that. Has that new book, Big Shield, August 19th, coming out on Amazon. Big thanks to him for the time. 216-474-0092. All right, the Quinshon Judkins thing gets even weirder because he's not signed. And then I was surprised that Quinshon Judkins' contract situation has something to do with other players after all this. I mean, if you were one of their agents, you'd be going nuts.
It is Tuesday at 4 o'clock, and when you think of Tuesday at 4 o'clock on this show, you know it means energy, it means passion, it means Cleveland on Cleveland sinful lust. That's why we're talking about John Fanta, college basketball on Fox, on the Fan Hotline. He joins us now. What's up, buddy?
What is happening, Nick? And Nick, great to be with you guys. Hope all is well.
Well, it's great to talk with you, buddy. We're excited. Camp gets underway here. For the Browns, and actually I'm going to pull a little bit of pivot here. We're actually going to start with the Browns because Albert Breer the other day in his mailbag said it wouldn't be fair to the rest of the team to drag the Browns quarterback, the starting quarterback race out. Do you agree with that, that whatever their decision is, they have to make it quickly?
I don't agree with that. I actually think that this is a real competition. And I think it helps Kevin Stefanski and his staff to maybe have an idea of what they want to do. But here's the thing, guys. Why rush something that doesn't have a ton of clarity heading into camp? I have been a proponent of, I don't think it's fair to send out either one of the rookies in week one. And I mean, I don't think that would happen to Dylan Gabriel, but obviously Shedeur Sanders is in the conversation, and you can't talk about the Browns without talking about Shedeur and his upside and the things that he could do for this franchise. But I also think that the Browns have nothing to lose heading into this year. I mean, they don't have really any expectations. I don't have many expectations for them. You guys might feel differently, but I mean, nobody expects if you ask any national media person, anybody that's outside of Cleveland, they don't see the Browns making the playoffs. So would naming a quarterback in the opening week of training camp, if it helps the team that much and I'm not seeing it, then maybe I'm wrong. But I don't think that Kevin Stefanski has to rush to a decision on something that, frankly, I don't think he knows the answer to, nor do I know the answer. And if the answer is Joe Flacco, what's the point of rushing a decision when Joe has been pressed into action last minute all the time throughout his career? I would let things play out a little bit. I'd get through a preseason game, and if you want to at that point make a declaration, that's fine. But I'm not entering training camp with, like, got to name a quarterback. For me, the dynamic of this football team and their honest expectations versus Kevin Stefanski and how you feel about him and how you feel he has to perform to keep his job. That's the most fascinating thing to me. If he feels it helps him, then maybe he'll name one soon. But I actually disagree, as much as I like Albert, I like him a lot, and the job that he does, that they have to just accelerate things on a competition that, frankly, seems like an open game.
John, you mentioned Joe Flacco there. We had a debate earlier in the show on if he is the fan favorite to be the week one starter amongst Browns fans this season. What do you have to say about that? Do you think Joe Flacco is the fan favorite for the Browns this year?
Of course he is. We wanted to give McKeem the city when he led the Browns to the playoffs. So Joe Flacco is a fan favorite. He's become a folk hero of sorts. And, you know, not Booby Gibson or, I don't know, Yu Chang level. There's a pull. this is different here. He actually led the football team. A football team that, frankly, you know, when the circumstances are what they are and Flacco enters, come on, guys, we didn't know what to expect. But he beat Father Time in that run, and eventually things caught up with him. And in the playoffs, things went south, and you know they were playing a Houston team that was just better than them on that day in every facet. And there's a variety of things that went wrong that day. But like Joe Flacco gave this franchise the last hope that people remember. So of course he's a fan favorite. I think if you asked any fan right now, they would say Joe Flacco or Shedeur Sanders because they're a big fan of Shedeur or they're a fan of the show and the hysteria. And I think that the Browns are probably going to get to a point where that eventually becomes their season, is can either one of these rookies play? You know, I think if you ask the fans, Kenny Pickett might finish last because, oh my, in a shocking turn of events, Cleveland Browns fans aren't huge on a guy who was wearing black and gold. But that's not how a quarterback competition gets judged. I have nothing against Kenny Pickett. He goes out there and he performs the best, and Kevin Stefanski believes that Kenny Pickett's the best option for him, then he goes with him. Here's what I will say, okay? And I actually disagree with people who are reporting this severely, and it's nothing against their work. But
sounds like you hate him.
I have never heard of a case that you walk into a season and people say, well, yeah, there's really no expectations on this season, and you know they're not looking at it from this season that they're fighting for their jobs. The biweekly paycheck and the expectations of being one of 32 men to either be a general manager or a head coach of an organization and the history of sports would say otherwise. When have you ever walked into a season and said about a guy who's been in the job for several years, when have you ever said, yeah, there's questions surrounding him, because there's questions around Stefanski. When have you said about someone, yeah, you know what? This year's kind of a wash. It really doesn't matter that much. That's false. And the Browns' history would say that too. Kevin Stefanski has pressure on him to show that he can still coach and win football games at this level. And the Browns' early schedule is hell. That early schedule is hard. If you ask the first three games, Bengals at Ravens, Packers, what's the most winnable game? Would you guys both agree it's week one against Cincinnati down by the lake?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's track record. Kevin Stefanski's outcoached Coach Taylor, and the Browns have had the Bengals number in Cleveland. If I'm Kevin, I'm not walking into week one with a rookie. I know that deep down they could say whatever they want messaging wise. I got to show that I can still coach a little bit. And week one's the most gettable division game, other than, you know, maybe Pittsburgh at home. You could say Heinz Field, Acrisure Stadium, whatever you want to call it, a dumpster fire in Pittsburgh is what I call it. You could say that place, you know, the Browns could win a game there. Guess what? They've won one, I think, in my lifetime. And I turned 30 yesterday. So
happy birthday.
I don't think – thank you. I don't think that – I think if you're Stefanski and you're the Browns, you walk into that week one game and you're going to put the guy out there that gives you the best shot to win. And it might not just be the fan favorite, but I would argue if you are trying to win games this year and you as the coach are trying to keep your job, I actually believe that Flacco week one is the move.
All right, John. So this brings us to an interesting conversation, given what you just said, What is more likely? Shedeur Sanders starts week one for the Browns or never plays it down in the regular season here?
Oh, it's the former. That's more likely. I mean, it's more likely that Sanders goes out, he shines, and he shines enough for the owner to walk into the room and say, I love this kid. Actually, I really don't care if we lose some games, but I saw Jaden Daniels and what he meant to Washington, and I want that for me too. Like that meme on social media, you know, that's what I want that for me. I could totally see there being a world where if Shedeur Sanders is close in this race and he does well enough in training camp, then do they do it week one? Why not? You know, again, they don't have anything to lose. And they could say that the powers that be could say, you know what, we don't really care about throwing him to the wolves. I'll just be candid here. Like, I wanted to see, this is just my theory. I don't think you can accurately judge the Browns roster last year on everything because the quarterback play was so damn dreadful. And so as a result, I'm a little concerned about a rookie who could be flawed, which most rookies are. Jaden Daniels don't grow on trees. A rookie who could be flawed going out there week one. And like I just said, I feel like this roster gets some level of an incomplete grade on last year because the defense was always on the field. And whatever Ken Dorsey was doing should have had him bagging groceries at Walmart, not, you know, doing whatever it is that he says he was doing. The fact is Sanders starting week one, though, is more likely than him never playing it down. Provided he's healthy, he's going to play at some point. There's no shot he ain't playing.
John, I want to switch some gears, talk a little bit of guards with you. Obviously, the 10-game losing streak happened, and it was dreadful, but they bounced back. They were able to get back in the win column against the Houston Astros and then took care of business against the Chicago White Sox. You feeling any differently about this Guardians team, or you still think they should probably sell everything off at the deadline?
Well, I don't think they should sell everything off. I think they should sell some things off that make sense for them from a business standpoint because they're still closer to the bottom than they are to the top, but that schedule is real in the second half in that it is easy. And this baseball team has not proven that they can just beat up on people. Although this past week, they showed me something. And when you come out of the break and you've got the Athletics and you've got the Orioles, who, by the way, have actually been playing better as of late, that series to me is going to be, and we're on, you know, I'm on with you guys. We're talking every Tuesday. I actually, in the Baltimore series, provided that Cleveland can take care of business against the Athletics, who, how many times have we just said a team name? They don't have a city attached to them right now. It's so strange. Provided that they could take care of business against the Athletics, that could be a sweep. At the end of the day, Detroit overcame a deficit similar to this in the second half last year, and look how well they were playing going into October. I think that the reports of a funeral or that the team was dead, I always thought those were premature. I think the way that the front office handled the offseason was not good. But a bad offseason became, now we're going to start declaring that they don't care at all and that they're a terrible organization. And that's just, that's unfair to the people who have actually done a lot of good over the last decade for this franchise and have put themselves in a position where they could have won a World Series. And frankly, they choked away a 3-1 lead and, you know, they've made a couple of championship series and it hasn't exactly gone their way. This window, the Athletics, Orioles, Royals, Rockies window is a position for them where could they win 12 of 16 games, 13 of 16 games? And their season turns in a weaker American League, an American League where now the Yankees are a wild card team because they're really, really struggling and showing that, yeah, in baseball, there's human element to this that we just can't solve. Yes. So I think the Guardians should do some selling. To what degree? We're going to find out when they come off this All-Star break and they have those two series against the Athletics and the Orioles. But make no mistake about it. If they win 5 of 6 or 6 of 7, yes, I do think Cleveland is going to trade one of their assets, because I think that they look at the business side of things and they look at always prospect trajectory upside, and that's how they do business, whether you like it or do not.
John, Stephen Kwan was quoted last night on the broadcast there of saying he doesn't want to leave Cleveland. How much weight should we put into Kwan saying he does want to stay here?
Well, Stephen comes off very genuine. Like, Francisco Lindor would – remember when Francisco Lindor was on the All-Star Game broadcast, guys, when the All-Star Game was in Cleveland, and he said, you know, this is my city, these are my people. I got to be honest with you, I didn't believe a word of that. I thought it was a lie. Like, in that moment, he might have been right, but we all knew he was not going to be back. Kwan's unique because there is this thought, like, around that clubhouse and around him, that he is this, you know, total gamer who has, you know, befriended Jose and is a little bit quirky, but in the best of ways, and is kind of a baseball nerd. I do think, and maybe a, you know, a year from now or whatever, that I'll be eating my words. I do think there's a degree of genuine character to what Kwan is saying. Do I put all the stock in the world of it? It's sports. It's business, guys. Of course not. I haven't heard where you two are on this, but I actually think that there's some truth to what he says, because I do think he genuinely loves being a Cleveland Guardian. And if he's saying that, then, yeah, a normal owner and a normal operation works out a way that they could keep him. And if you don't, it's yet another scar in a long list of things that you were unable to do. I would say if there's anybody that should do it for, it's Stephen Kwan, and I don't know what the business side of it's going to look like, but I know he's going to be demanding of more money, as he should. History would tell us the Guardians typically don't do this. Jose Ramirez is to not grow on trees. It's why I actually think there should be a statue for that man someday for taking the pay cut that he did and keeping this franchise to the level it's been on. But for me, I actually believe there's some truth to what Kwan said.
John, we appreciate you, buddy. You killed it, as always. We'll talk to you next week as we're getting underway for training camp.
Thank you, fellas. Nick and Nick, I expect you guys to be on YouTube and looking at past training camp clips to start working on the biggest thing this time of year, charting passes.
You got to watch the tape. You did, that's it. I'm a big tape watcher. Everybody knows.
You major in pass charting.
It's what people say. My charts are undeniable. Johnny, be good, bud.
Undeniable.
Thanks, John.
See you guys.
John Fanta there, College Basketball on Fox, Cleveland Zone. He joins us every week on the Fan Hotline. We'll react to what he had to say. And we will get to Stephen Kwan, who said it with his chest, meaning it's time for the Kwanversation in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
You can read his work at brownzone.com. He's not happy that he has a headline there that says rookie Quinshon Judkins arrested in Florida on domestic violence charge, but he had to write the story. He's Mr. Scott Petrak. Hello, Scott.
How's it going, guys?
Hey, Scott.
Okay. Hey, just for to set the record straight on this a little bit, I just happened to look up on the Browns roster just to check in the number of running backs, and I made note that Quinshon Judkins is no longer listed on the Browns website on the roster. And I thought, well, I wonder, is that because he's not signed as a second-round pick? For whatever it's worth, Travion Henderson and Luther Burden, both second-round picks, both unsigned on the respective websites of the Patriots and the Bears. So for whatever that's worth, right now Judkins is not listed on the roster.
Yeah, that he hadn't been on there because he was unsigned. So even before this, he was in his own separate category on there.
Okay, so other teams are and our team isn't. So that's fine.
Correct.
Regardless, is he in uniform? We don't know that. We're going to have to let this play out. Well, all we know is that something happened and it's a bad look, Scott.
Oh, there's no doubt about it, Jeff. And, you know, from a non-football perspective, it's terrible. Anytime you hear domestic violence, and obviously we have to let the situation play out and see how it develops. But anytime you hear domestic violence, it's terrible. It's a bad look for the player, the organization, for the league. The league has made some efforts to try to increase the penalties for anything related to domestic violence, especially, you know, following that Ray Rice incident. So yeah, it's bad. It's bad that the Browns have to deal with it. It's bad for the fans that they, you know, have to be put through this, and it's not the first time. It's not the first time this offseason Devin Bush said something. It's still in the court process. Last year, Mike Hall Jr., another second-round pick out of Ohio State, faced you know, I don't know how similar the cases are, but it was a domestic violence or domestic incident in his house that got him suspended for, I think, it was 5 games. So the Browns have been through this before. So that's the off the field. And then from a football perspective, you know, the Browns are counting on Quinshon Judkins to be, I think, the workhorse back. And we have talked all offseason about the recommitment to the run. Well, you don't draft a guy at number 36. You don't draft a running back at number 36 without the expectation that he is going to help transform that run game, be the number one guy. I expected it to be week one. I don't know if that changes given this weekend's events. It could, if he's suspended by the league and not available week one, it could affect how the Browns view him. That's to be determined. But, you know, when you look at, okay, the formula to win games is run the ball a bunch and play great defense. You need that number one back to run the ball. And right now, I would say there's uncertainty with the guy I thought was going to be their number one back.
So how do you think they approach it? Do they go into this going, okay, well, we got to plan on him probably being out for 6 weeks? Or, I mean, it doesn't matter if he's guilty or not guilty or any of that. I mean, the league's going to do what they want, right? And if the standard is 6 games, how do you approach this if you're the Browns offense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we know that he won't be there week one. I think you have to let it play out a little bit longer. But they have Jerome Ford, and I think Jerome Ford's value went up this weekend with the arrest of Quinshon Judkins. You know, I like Jerome Ford. I don't think he's a big-time starting back in this league, but he is a NFL running back. There's no doubt about that. He has started plenty of games with this team, but they went and drafted Quinshon Judkins and Dylan Sampson for a reason. They wanted an upgrade at running back. So, you know, I don't know if it's 50-50 or what the chances are, but I think the chances are much better right now that Jerome Ford's your week one starter, and I think it also increases the chances of playing time for Dylan Sampson, who spent a lot of the offseason working at slot receiver. Maybe he becomes the third down back, which was probably a role that was going to be Jerome Ford's. You know, Pierre Strong, where does he fit in this running back room now? You know, I just think there's a lot of uncertainty, but I don't think they're going to stop with their goal of running the ball. I think that's still going to be the plan, and they're just going to have to use those other guys on the roster.
Scott Petrak joining us from the Chronicle-Telegram, brownszone.com. Dylan Sampson, to me, was sitting there as, okay, well, I hope you get some opportunities to show what you can do, and, well, you seem really intriguing. This could lead to more opportunities for him. Scott, guy led his conference in rushing and touchdowns last year, and he looks like he's he could become a big-time running back. This is an opportunity that he wasn't expecting, probably. We'll see how it plays out. But, man, if it leads to an opportunity for him, he's got to jump all over that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think he's an interesting case, Jeff, because when they drafted him, I really liked him at Tennessee. And I know he's not the biggest guy. He's 5'8".
Ran hard, though. Ran between the tackles really well.
Yeah, he does run hard. And he got a bunch of carries in his 1 year as a starter at Tennessee. So I spent a lot of the offseason asking coaches and people and his former coaches and even Dylan, like, you know, where do you fit with Quinshon? Is it a thunder and lightning thing? Are you guys similar? And I thought that Dylan Sampson could be more of a featured back as well. But the more people I talked to, and even Deuce Staley, when we talked to him at the end of minicamp, made it sound like, no, he is the change of pace. He's a guy they're going to use at receiver. Yes, he can play some third down. But I had no indication that, okay, he's going to get a bunch of reps, you know, on first and second down as the ball carrier. Well, that could change now, right? I mean, that's where this could get interesting. And I think he has that ability. I think there's some worry that, you know, because he's not the biggest body, that you can only use him so much. So they would probably, you know, balance him with Jerome Ford. But if Quinshon Judkins misses any amount of time for whatever reason, I do think that gives Dylan Sampson an opportunity that I don't think he necessarily would have had early on in his career as a true ball carrier.
Scott, how does I think part of it is like people are going, oh, the Browns, here we go with the Browns again. But it's a league-wide problem. It's not just the Browns. The Browns are maybe in the upper half of the middle of the pack when it comes to players arrested. I don't know. What can the league possibly do to try to stop these guys from just – and I don't have the facts in front of it, but I wonder how many of these arrests actually happen between the end of mini camp and the beginning of regular camp. What can the league do?
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard what Dan was saying before you guys went to commercial. Yeah, you know, I don't know where the Browns rank. I know that obviously we're so focused on the Browns that it feels like everything is, oh my gosh, drama. And I'm not going to ignore that. And the Deshaun Watson, according to Deshaun Watson, with everything that he was going on, that everything that was going on with him, right, the two dozen sexual misconduct allegations, like that just tilts the scale so much. But if you took Deshaun Watson out of the equation, then, you know, I think the Browns are probably ranked with most teams. I would argue that I don't think it's gotten any worse with Andrew Barry and Kevin Stefanski. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I remember sitting in front of John Dorsey, having him explain the decision to draft Antonio Callaway and to sign Kareem Hunt, right, when he was going through things. So I don't think this is necessarily a Barry Stefanski thing. But when you ask about the league, you know, I don't know, Andy, it's doing as much as it can, or it's trying to do a lot. You know, the league's hands are tied by just how much you can do, you know, given the criminal justice system and, you know, how much jurisdiction you have. Can you suspend a guy forever? And I mean, there's just a lot of issues that go on that I think makes it hard for the league. And then you have the added factor of, well, you don't want to sit down your best players forever, right? Or for a long time. I mean, I don't know if that's right or wrong. I just know that that's a concern for the league, right? If Tyreek Hill gets into trouble, I don't think the league wants to sit down Tyreek Hill for a long time because he's one of his, you know, most electrifying players. So the league has to deal with that. It's a business. I don't agree with a lot of stuff the league does. I'm sure it could come down harder, and I know it could have come down earlier, right? I feel like even any of the emphasis in the last decade on trying to curb domestic violence and crack down on the players was late. And I think they're trying to make up ground and have they made up enough? Probably not. I think that is a concern for them. But I would also say, you know, it's a societal problem too. So I don't think it's just the NFL. But the spotlight is so bright, and we write about it and we talk about it, that it can't be ignored, and it shouldn't be ignored. I just think it's a really difficult problem to say, okay, Roger Goodell, you know, make sure how many guys are in the league? 1,500 guys in your league, that nobody's doing anything stupid between, you know, June 1st and July 25th.
Scott Petrak joining us from the Chronicle Telegram, brownzone.com. That situation will play out. We'll see where more facts should emerge. We'll find out, and we'll see if he's able to go. So I think we've covered that one pretty well. Let me ask you this one, though. With rookies starting up on Friday, how in the world are they going to get reps for four quarterbacks and make a decision? How's that going to work? Any idea?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be easy, and I don't even know if that's – I'm not sure that that's the number one goal.
Yeah, Jeff. Is it even a plan? You know, that's
right. Yeah, I think it was during OTAs and minicamp, certainly, and we saw the two fields with, you know, a lot of times it was the rookies or even just Shedeur Sanders on one field getting reps to maximize that. I think in training camp it makes it harder to do. I could see the first week – before they go into any kind of game planning for the preseason, while they're still, you know, going over installations again, I could see them split the fields and have simultaneous drills going on to get the quarterbacks as many reps as possible. But I think at some point that has to stop, and I think it will be relatively early. And then you see, I would suspect, you see Shedeur Sanders get way fewer reps than the other three guys. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's closed the gap or passed Dylan Gabriel. I don't get that sense, even though I thought he performed better in the offseason than Dylan Gabriel. And I think it's about Joe Flacco versus Kenny Pickett, who's going to be your starting quarterback, and then where Dylan Gabriel fits in to that discussion. Does he really have a chance? Are you looking at him to be the backup, or are you going to keep four and have whoever loses the starting quarterback job between Pickett and Flacco be the backup. And I don't know how they feel about that. I kind of, part of me thinks that it's going to be a rookie that's going to be the backup and they move on from one of the veterans, but I could certainly see them keeping all four guys.
What's your take on Kenny Pickett and Jerry Jeudy working out here in the offseason on their own time?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good. You know, that's common throughout the league. It's been common with Browns quarterbacks in the past. You know, they have a history. I remember the first time we talked to Kenny after the Browns traded for him. He mentioned that he had worked out with Jerry Jeudy in Florida. So I think that's helpful. Jeudy's by far the number one receiver on this team. So if Kenny Pickett's going to get some chemistry with anybody, that'd be a great guy to get it with. I don't know if that tips the scales at all when we're talking about who's going to be your starter week one.
All right. I'm sorry you had to write something you weren't expecting to write, and you're going to lead to more stories on the same subject, but we'll be following you on brownzone.com and get all the news we need to have. Thanks, bud.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Scott.
Scott Petrak on the Fan Hotline.
Let's go to the Fan Hotline, where we have Anthony Castrovitz from MLB.com as well as MLB Network, where Mitch has written, he's already in Atlanta for All-Star Week. I'm going, yeah, the home run derby's tonight, bud. Anthony Castrovitz joins us right now. Hello, Anthony.
Oh, I've been down here. I'm basically a lifer when it comes to the 2025 All-Star festivities. So, we're locked and ready for tonight.
Hey, can I ask you a weird question? How's that whole neighborhood around Truist Park and everything? We're trying to do the same thing up here. How's that look?
Yeah. It's like everywhere you go, you see the same thing. I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's a great pregame atmosphere and everything. But, you know, you got your yard house. You got your, you know, like the hip place where you go bowling. You know, there's always one of those. You know, there's some shops. And I don't know. I don't think I'm the target audience, but it's perfectly fine. It's going to really liven up Brook Park, let me tell you that.
Anthony Castrovitz joining us. Follow him on Twitter, @Castrovitz on Twitter. He is on the Fan Hotline. So Guardians, they finish up the first half of the season strong after a 10-game losing streak, and they were like something like 9-21 over their last 30 before they started winning again. Is this a team that can still make a run towards a wild card, or should they think about liquidating some of these assets for the future?
Maybe both, you know. The Tigers were sellers at last year's deadline, and look what happened to them in the last 2 months. You know, they played their young guys and took off. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen to the Guardians, because the math is definitely against them right now. The schedule's pretty light coming out of the break, so that could work in their favor. But it's just been it's been a frustrating season doesn't begin to cover it. You know, it's kind of been worst case scenario, and all the things last year we were saying, how are they doing this? Now we're like going the other way. We're like, how has it gotten this bad? So the truth is probably somewhere in the middle between those two teams. But, if they can take advantage of this light schedule prior to the trade deadline, that could impact their decision making. But if not, you know, they could really be a team that takes advantage of what is clearly a seller's market.
Did you see anything different in this team over the last two series? Obviously it's the White Sox, and Houston did have some players out, but did in any way, shape or form, did you say, wow, that's actually a team more capable than I previously thought?
Well, it all just comes down to how much life they show offensively. They put six runs on Hunter Brown and Cy Young candidate. You know, that was great to see. They had such a miserable month of June that you forgot what it looks like when they score runs, you know? So that came to life again. But at the end of the day, you know, they have so many lineup holes, and they are so dependent on Stephen Kwan and Jose Ramirez. And after that, it's just huge question marks all over the place. And that's why when you think ahead to the second half, I mean, you would hope and think that they free up some opportunities for their younger guys in the system. By that, I mean, of course, Chase DeLauder and maybe CJ Capus, but, you know, doing that might require doing something with Carlos Santana, making some uncomfortable decisions in the outfield as well. So we'll see, they needed something in that moment. And that Houston series was, good for the soul for sure.
Is Carlos Santana on his way out by the end of the month?
I mean, I don't know what the market would be for him in trade. I just, you know, just logically, I mean, guy's almost 40 years old. He's got a sub 700 OPS, and you know, you got it. If it's a lost season, if it's a season where they're just not going to contend anyway, I mean, you have to take advantage of at bats and opportunities at the major league level. You have to find those for the guys in your system who are knocking on the door. So, I don't know what that means for Carlos Santana, if it would be more of a reduced role or if it would be a trade. But I would hope for his sake, you know, if it is going to be going down that road, then I would hope that he gets to go to a place where, you know, his veteran presence is valued and he can help a team down the stretch that's in contention. But, you know, as you said, maybe this team gets back in contention. It's hard to envision him going forward as an everyday player just because of his age and the production offensively.
Anthony Castrovin's joining us right now, getting ready for the All-Star festivities. So we had an All-Star closer a year ago that was the best closer in baseball. So far this year, obviously has not matched what it was last year, but he still had his moments. They do have him under team control. So how do you see this situation playing out?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely getting, you know, people are showing interest in him, as you would expect. I mean, the bullpen environment in Major League Baseball this year is rough. You know, there's a lot of teams going to be looking for help in that area at the deadline, a lot of very good teams. And, you know, his stuff still plays up. You know, I know the numbers, particularly because of what happened in the first month, you know, the numbers aren't what they were last year, but he's still got elite stuff. And it's interesting because this is the kind of guy the Guardians trade in that, you know, he's getting more expensive for them relative to the rest. I want to say it's like $6 or $7 million next year. And then he's got the options for, I believe, $10 million apiece, you know, the 2 years after that. You know, for the Guardians, that's a significant percentage of your payroll, unfortunately. For bigger market teams, not so much. So this is sometimes a moment where thinking like Andrés Giménez, right? Where, you know, where the contract starts to become untenable for them. I'm not saying Class A's is as, you know, with Giménez, it was a very much sub-average bat, you know, started to take up a larger percentage of payroll. Class A is a key guy in this club. But this is often a moment where, as an organization, they explore a guy's trade value. So I wouldn't be shocked if a deal came down. You don't necessarily expect it or predict it, but it wouldn't be shocking, I don't think, for anybody. And there's definitely interest in him out there.
What I'd be really surprised with, Anthony Castrovitz joining us on the show, I'm reading about Cade Smith and possibilities with a trade with him, and I'm thinking, why? Is that other teams trying to speak this thing maybe into existence or grease the rail or something?
I would think so, because, again, that's the guy they build around. You know, they build around the guys who are pre-arbitration, and, no, I mean, that wouldn't make a tremendous amount of sense to me.
Anthony Castrovitz with us on the show. So, for Stephen Vogt, I mean, this has been his first real tough stretch. I knew he had lost 7 in a row last year, but that was a real tough stretch of a month. We're getting 9-21, I think, over their 30 up until Monday when they started win. Last Monday when they started winning again. For him, what do you think were the challenges for him of leading this team where they've taken away payroll from an ALCS team? They're still kind of handcuffed by what their payroll is, and you know, a lot of people are beating down the door for some of these pups to come up from Columbus.
Yeah, I mean, this is the reality of the job that he didn't have to face last year, to his credit. You know, I mean, that team exceeded expectations from day one. And you mentioned, as you said, there was one long losing streak, but there was always a sense last year that, man, they are getting the absolute most out of his roster. He's crushing it with the bullpen moves. You know, it was fun to watch. This year has not been as fun to watch. So this is where, you know, the other side of the coin, and he gets tested for the first time as a manager to go through moments like this. And you've seen tremendous consistency from him in terms of how he relates to players, how he relates to the media, et cetera. Sometimes you want to bang your head against the wall as a media member, because he keeps repeating, like, you know, this is not who we are. And he can only say that so many times before it's like, well, maybe this is who you are. But, no, I mean, this is why he got the job, is just that demeanor, you know, that steadiness, the ability to work well with the front office, all those things have all, you know, been steady throughout a very rocky first half of 2025.
Jacob Mizorowski ends up making the All-Star team late. He was just appointed in only 25 innings. I know that there's some old-time baseball fans who are very upset by that. I think in any sport there would be some older fans who are upset by that. Do you think it's a good thing, or do you question this move here with him being on the All-Star team?
I think it's a great thing. I've advocated for a while, and this is maybe not the way to do it, but, you know, this should be a spectacle, and maybe each roster just needs a spot for a guy who's just maybe a young guy or whatever. Just somebody who's just flat out, like, has the attention of fans, as this kid, the Miz, does right now. And he just ran into a situation where, I mean, you need people to pitch in the game. I know that when he was named, people were throwing out, you know, other guys who had better, you know, more of a track record this season and all that. But at the end of the day, like, people are going to be more excited to see this kid than they are, you know, Christopher Sanchez or Ranger Suarez, you know. And there was an attempt by the league to offer a spot to those guys, but various people kind of turned it down because they're pitching over the weekend leading up to it, and they didn't want to pitch an inning in an All-Star game. And the whole point of being a replacement is you're available to pitch in the game or play in the game. You know, that's the whole point. That's why we replaced the originally named All-Stars, is to have people who can, you know, take those innings or at bats. So the Miz was willing to do that, and lo and behold, here we are. So I think this is a easier sell for the All-Star game. Hey, look at this kid, man. He's only made 5 starts in the big leagues, but he's electric. He's getting the attention of all of his peers. He's a great story. So let's showcase that.
Robot umps, your thoughts?
Yeah, and it's a misnomer, because what you're going to see at the All-Star game tomorrow night and in all likelihood next season is not quote-unquote robot umps, because it's still the umpire is still calling every ball and strike in every game. It's just that it's the challenge system where you have, you know, for the game tomorrow night, and I would assume this would appear to be where they're leaning going forward, is you have 2 challenges per team. Only the pitcher, the hitter, or the catcher can ask for a challenge. And it's all very fast. It's like the Hawkeye thing in tennis, you know, is the ball in or out? It works very quickly. It adds kind of a fun strategic angle to the game of, you know, saving your challenges versus using your challenges. And, you know, I've seen it many times now in minor league baseball, and they've used it in some, you know, futures game and spring training this year. And it's so streamlined that you could very easily miss it even happening. And so it's just about getting like the biggest calls, making sure the biggest calls are right, should there be any controversy, you know, on the part of the players. So it's a net positive. And yeah, so robot umps are tremendously unpopular within baseball, because they did experiment with that, with full robot umps, and the umpire just back there, you know, with the quote-unquote robot call in his earpiece. And yeah, this slows the game down. There's more walks. People hated it. And it didn't really have the traditional way games are called.
Well, why did it? What do you mean by it slowed the game down? Is it because it had a very rigid?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, can't they just change that?
Well, they can. Yeah, but you know, there's just kind of that art to umpiring, right? Where it's a 10-1 game, and they kind of move the game along. You know, veteran guys kind of hitting his spots. You might give him a little bit off the black. Now that's changed a little bit too, just because the way umpires are graded, but it's still in there. I mean, there's still a human element to umpiring, and it's people that it's things that people within the game accept. And yeah, like I said, I mean, they did it for a while. They tried full robot umps for quite a while, and it didn't pass the smell test. So the challenge system has been very popular, and you know, it worked well in spring training. Doesn't add much time to the game. It's on average 4 pitches a game, you know, that are impacted by it. And they are conceivably the biggest pitches. And also it actually gives you a pretty good appreciation for the umpires doing a pretty good job, because those 4 pitches a night that were the quote unquote, maybe most controversial pitches, they were still getting them right about half the time. You know, the challenge was not upheld. So I love it, man. I think it's kind of fun. I love the strategic angle of it, and I think fans are going to like it too.
Can I put you in a bad spot?
Sure.
What can you tell us?
I love being in a bad spot.
What can you tell us about Laviolette, if anything?
Just that he goes against the grain of what they've targeted, generally speaking, in recent drafts. You know, for one, he's 6'6". Uh-huh. They've been known to take a lot of little guys, and you know, he's got big power and also big risk. You know, big swing and miss. He did have the hand injury and surgery at the end of the year, but that doesn't seem to be a big concern, but the swing and miss is the bigger concern. And, but yeah, it's nice to see them kind of go a different direction. Obviously their position player development has been very, you know, inconsistent and maybe too consistent in some ways, where, I mean, you hit on a Steven Kwan. I mean, that's a great, you know, that's great. But they've tried to go that mold in general with smaller, undervalued guys or bat-to-ball skills. And the game is trending that way, so it makes sense. But you got to have some pop. You got to have guys who can hit the ball over the fence. And they drafted a few last night. So that is clearly a strategy of theirs for this particular draft, where they had a quantity in picks, But, you know, their first pick was at number 27 overall as a result of their success last season. And so you could see them taking some calculated gambles with those picks and going for some pop.
You're saying the league is trending back towards complete hitters, not just boppers?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to have more hits. Right now we have more hits than strikeouts for the first time since 2017. Yeah, this is what baseball, this is what Major League Baseball engineered. And I would say it's the right thing to engineer. I mean, it looks, it actually, you can compare this year's numbers in terms of time of game, you know, hits per game, runs per game, et cetera. It's 1985. It's like it mirrors 1985. So that is just a brand of baseball that's just more fun to watch. We still have the home run hitters. We still have, I mean, we have a catcher with 38 home runs at the break, you know. There's still a lot of that going on, but you have to have athleticism in your lineup, some speed in your lineup, and bat to ball skills to take full advantage of this environment with the rules.
Find him on Twitter at @CastroVince. Anthony, thank you very much for the time. All the best. Enjoy this evening and the week.
Thanks, guys. Good to hear from you.
Anthony CastroVince on the Fan Hotline. All right. One question about that when we come back with the, you want full robot umps? You're not going to get full robot umps.
To talk all things Gardos of the Locked On Guardians podcast, the great Justin Latta joins us. What's up, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing good. No sleep last night, but I'm ready to go and do this all over again today. I've been doing it already all day.
So we'll get to the draft stuff here because there's an obviously there's a right turn the Guardians have made here, but you know the first half of the season has come and gone. I believe there's still three games below 500. Compared to where you thought they were going to be this season, how did the first half of the season grade out versus where you expected them to be?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought they'd hover around 500 most of the year. I think coming into the year, for sure, the idea was they improved the starting pitching, which was going to combat any bullpen regression they had from a year ago. And then you were hoping to win a lot of, you know, 3-2 baseball games, which obviously didn't happen because they had a hard time hitting, and the starting pitching also didn't do all that great to start the season. They found their footing a little bit since then. You know, 10-game losing streaks are going to take a lot out of you. If they go 5-5 there, you're, you know, looking kind of close to what that is. So, yeah, the offense, like, there are certain guys that just didn't develop. Like, Kyle Manzaro had a great April, didn't continue that all year. He got a little bit better lately. They had to send Brian Rocchio back down. He's back playing a little bit better. I really was a little bit higher on the reacquisition of Nolan Jones. That hasn't panned out. You know, he's been better lately. I also thought Lane Thomas was going to have a great contract year, to be honest, and it's been, you know, a lost season for him. So I think a lot of guys offensively, they were counting on to step up this year and boost the offense, didn't take that step forward, and that's kind of why you saw things fall on them offensively throughout the year, and that's why they are where they are.
How much of this team is going to be Sellers? Is it going to be more than just Class A? Do you think Kwan gets thrown in the mix there as well?
I don't think either of them are going to be traded, to be honest with you. I don't see a reason for the Guardians to, like, they can listen on Class A. They, you know, they don't hang up the phone on anybody except for Jose Ramirez. They're going to take offers, but I just don't see anybody making the kind of offer that they're going to bite on when it comes to Class A. They got him for next year for six-something million. That's still relatively cheap. And if you trade Class A, you're not going to get guys that are going to really help you next year. Like, remember, they got Manzaro for Aaron Civale, and he wasn't really enough at all last year, and he's still going through it this year. You know, Class A obviously is much better than Aaron Civale, but I just don't see anybody ponying up for that. And if you trade him, you know, you got to pay Cade Smith more money because he's going to be your closer, which means he goes into arbitration without a deal and saves jack up arbitration prices. So, and then they don't have the bullpen depth to survive that either. So I just don't see them getting an offer where they say, yeah, this makes sense for us. Like, I think they'd do it if they got an offer, but I just don't see that offer coming. And as for Kwan, you know, that's a conversation you can revisit in the offseason. I feel like both of them in the offseason. I just don't see that. I don't think their position changes. I think maybe they'll try to get something for Carlos Santana. If Paul Sewald has a good couple of games before the break, he's somebody. Like, I just don't see the offer being big enough for them to pull the trigger on those kind of deals.
Justin, what shot do you give them for a second half run, make it into the wild card?
Well, I mean, you won 6-7, and that put them, what, like four and a half back, I want to say, of a wild card spot. The pitching staff's getting better. Like, Tanner Bibee's still working on consistency. their schedule out of the break is really soft. You've got the Royals, the Rockies, the Orioles who are struggling. Their schedule before the All-Star break, the Athletics are coming to town who are pesky but aren't having a great year. If they have a nice stretch there before the trade deadline, I could see them kind of having a shot at it. But they're also going to have to call guys up. Like, you're going to have DeLauder up. You're going to have Kapus. And you've got to break in those rookie guys. So it's still a coin flip, to be honest, because you're going to bring guys up from the minors at some point, and those guys have to get acclimated. They have to go through struggles, or maybe they'll be hot and they'll cool off. So it's going to be a 50-50 shot, and I don't see them being major buyers anyway. So it's really a coin flip in the second half, and that's only if they have a if they take advantage of this soft stretch coming out of the break.
Justin, I've said, given Lane's been injured this year and given the fact that he is having as bad of a season as you possibly could going into free agency year, I think they should pick up the phone and say, hey, well, what about a one-year bridge deal so you can focus on getting healthy? And when you play this year, we can kind of spring forward next year. What do you think about that?
That's a great idea. You're 100% right. I agree with that idea because they don't have a surefire option for next year. Like, if Lane Thomas goes into free agency and they don't want him to come back, then, you know, Nolan Jones is your center fielder who's been most of the year, because DeLauder's not a center fielder. You can't do it there because he already can't stay healthy. You put him in center, you're going to put him even under more duress. Kwan can't play center, or you don't want him to because of arbitration and his hamstring issue. So, yeah, I think Lane Thomas coming back, unless you really want to believe you want to throw Angel Martinez in center full-time next year, which is an option. You know, you could put Angel Martinez in center field next year full-time. There's Daniel Sheeman who can handle second. Hopefully next year you have Travis Bazzana. But I would 100% be open to the option of bringing Lane Thomas back, because at the worst, you bring Lane Thomas back next year, he goes back into the role where he really fits the best, and that's hitting left-handed pitching and maybe playing right field in some sort of like quasi-platoon between center and right.
All right, tell us about Lord Tubbington. Do you like the pick? So last year he was constantly talked about being like 1-1. He was raved about from everyone, and then this last season it just didn't go as well for him. But obviously he's still taken in the first round, and imagine a highly touted prospect.
He was, yeah. I mean, I think some of the 1-1 talk was a little overblown. Part of that is because this is just not a good draft class. Like, this is a year. I can't even count the number of guys. Like, there's a guy who next year, Rock Chalowski from UCLA, that if he was eligible this year, he would have been the first overall pick, I feel like. It was not a great draft year. So him being 1-1, whether it was overhype or the fact that it was just a bad class, I don't necessarily buy that. But, yeah, I mean, he's got a lot of power. There's a lot of exciting tools. You know, people really like his work ethic and drive and who he is as a character. I mean, well, you don't get the nickname Lord Tubbington by accident. It's a fun player. It's a totally different profile than the Guardians have gone for in the past. It comes with a ton of risk. There just aren't a lot of examples in the major leagues, if any, of guys that have had his strikeout issues in college that have succeeded in the pros. It's the third. I'm not a big believer in batting average at the pro level, but in terms of how successful that makes you. But in college, when you have a low batting average, it's kind of a red flag. And he had the third lowest batting average, I want to say, in like the last 40-something years of where he got drafted. So it's a big risk profile. There's a lot of tools there. They're pivoting on what they do, and we'll see if they can make those things work for them in a way that they couldn't make guys who don't hit for any power teaching them power.
Justin Latta on the fan hotline here with Nick and Jonathan breaking down the first half of the Guardian season, what to expect in the second half, and of course the draft, which began yesterday. So specific to LaViolette, is he somebody that can move quickly given that he's a college bat, or should we expect this one to take time?
I would expect it to take a little bit of time because, A, you know, he had another procedure to clean up the wrist issue he had late in the season during the SEC tournament. So, number one, I would lean on the side that he's not even going to play this year in pro ball, because they didn't set any expectations of a timeline of when he's going to play, because they want to go through and make sure, you know, it makes sense for him. I didn't get the indication yesterday that they were going to be pushing the button for him to play this year. So I would not be shocked if he doesn't play at all this year. And then you go into next year, he's got to start at the beginning, and you got to see, like, if he has a lot of the same issues in the minors next year, where he has a lot of swing and miss in the zone, It might take time. He does draw walks, but yeah, I wouldn't necessarily sit there and say he's going to move really fast. I mean, Travis Bazana's not, I know he got hurt, but he's not even up yet. So like if a player like that's not up that fast, I don't see Jace Laviolette. This is not a great draft class overall. So I just don't see Laviolette as a guy who you're like, okay, next year he's in the majors. Like I think it's 2027, I think would be a good timeline for him.
What do you make in their philosophy change where instead of just a lot of contact guys, now they're going for some more power?
I mean, it's good that they changed their approach. Clearly what they were doing was not working. It took a lot of up the middle guys who hit the had a lot of contact, and they thought, well, it's easier to teach guys to hit power who can already make contact, but that has not worked out for them at all. And they don't have any impact, and they don't have any corner bats in the system. I mean, they have, you know, Capus and DeLauder, and they've got some other guys. Everybody else is up the middle. So, you know, it's a necessary change in philosophy that way. It's just they took such a hard, like you said, Nick, a hard right turn on what they were doing. And I don't think there was a real way for them to find balance in this draft because you weren't going to find the right fit in terms of guys who make enough contact but also hit for power and have some position. Like, there was just no perfect fit for them. So maybe this is taking advantage of value. I'll be curious to see. Like, they've leaned into it. I'll be curious to see if this is a trend now because this wasn't a great draft class. Did they pounce on value? Have they changed their philosophy? Did they go because it was a very weak draft class? I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Like, what they were doing didn't work. So I'm curious to see how it works out. I'm a little bit of a skeptic, to be honest with you.
Justin, what's the latest on last year's number one pick overall and his trajectory to hit the majors?
So Travis Bazana had the oblique or the core issue a couple months ago in Akron. He is now playing rehab games in Arizona. I don't believe he's played a back-to-back game yet at second base. He's alternated between second base and DH. So I would imagine they're going to also, you know, wait on something like that. They also don't play whole nine-inning games in Arizona because it's 100 million degrees in Arizona this time of year. So it probably, I would guess he's back in Akron by the end of July. And then, you know, maybe sometime in September he gets to Columbus. That'd be ideal. And then I think we're talking next year. I don't think the Guardians position this year, given that Bazana got hurt in this time and where they're at, and I don't think it makes sense to bring him to the majors this year. I mean, you could maybe try for a September call-up and maybe keep his rookie eligibility for 2026, and he can do one of those prospect promotion draft pick rookie of the year campaigns. But I would think it's more likely that we're going to see him next year.
We've had some injuries, obviously, but the Kafis, DeWater, Brito trio, is there anything? Didn't mean to make that rhyme, but it just did.
I kind of want them to all come up together now so we can see.
You can
that.
Call them the Brito yeah. trio? Yeah, I like that. Is there anything there? Do you see any one of them coming up in the next, I don't know, let's say 3 weeks?
I hope so. I mean, Brito, I don't know, because Brito's back on the injured list with a hamstring strain, so he's currently out again. He came back for 8 games. And then he hurt his hamstring. So Brito, yeah. Totally up in the air, which stinks. Because I think Brito for sure would have been up a while ago if he was healthy. And then DeLauder might have been too if he didn't break camp injured. So maybe he would have been too. So I would think that DeLauder, as long as this wrist issue that he sat out with the last couple of games is not anything major, he should be up sometime in July or August. I can't imagine any reasons not to call him up at this point, at that point of time, if the wrist injury isn't serious. And then if you do trade Carlos Santana, you do open up at bats for Kafis. So I would think by the end of the year, both those guys should be in the majors. And I hope that Brito's healthy enough to be up, because like I said, he would have been, to me, the first one that would have been up because he was battling at second base with Arias in spring training.
Justin, before we go, what do you kind of think are Shane Bieber and I almost said Justin Lotta, John Means' roles in the second half of the season here?
I'm really interested in the Bieber thing. There's so much debate about like whether or not he'll have trade value, right? Because I don't even know if he's – I don't think he's – I mean, he's going to pitch in Arizona here tomorrow or Wednesday. I don't think he's going to have time to pitch a major league rehab or a major league game. So, like, how much trade value is he going to have? I know the Guardians traded for Alex Cobb last year. So I just don't know for sure if someone's going to buy in on him as a trade candidate. We'll see. And I also think he might prefer to stay here just because he trusts them. That's why he re-signed with the injury. So Bieber, you know, he can come back and step in if he comes back healthy and the pitching rotation just gets that much better, hopefully, if he's looking good. And, you know, as far as John Means, I guess we'll see how the Luis Ortiz situation pans out. But if John Means comes back in August and looks interesting, like, that's a guy you have for next year guaranteed. Hopefully he looks good. This is his second Tommy John, so there's a little bit more concern there. But given the uncertainty with the Luis Ortiz thing, those guys might actually play really important roles, especially Bieber, obviously.
Yeah, Steve Phillips was on last week and treated JP like an idiot for asking about trading Shane Bieber. Meanwhile, social media streets have been talking about this, and JP's been talking about it for a minute.
Don't worry, Justin. I treated Steve Phillips like he's an idiot, too.
That's okay. I mean, Steve Phillips knows more than I do, so if he's an idiot, then I'm an idiot.
We can all be idiots together.
We've been saying that for a while. Justin, really good stuff, buddy. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you.
Justin Latta there, Locked On Guardians on the Fan Hotline.
Steve was like offended was the problem there.
He was, yeah.
He was like, you're even asking about
Bieber? You insulted his intelligence by asking that.
The audacity of a Cleveland sports radio host to ask about a pitcher in the city.
When we've got multiple instances of guys being traded despite not pitching again. But never mind. It doesn't matter. Alex Cobb being one of them, which Justin was so kind to mention there. We'll react to what Justin had to say about the situation with the Gardos and the Peterlin pass in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
I'm Jeff Phelps. My buddy's Andy Baskin. Let's go to the Fan Hotline. He's been with us many times before. We love him. He does a great job covering Major League Baseball for CBS Sports. He's Mr. Mike Exisa. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
I'm shocked, Mike. Four college hitters. Big guys who hit the ball. Somebody took over the Guardians draft room and didn't let the Guardians in. What was going on?
Yeah, you know, the Laviolette pick, I mean, you look coming into 2025, just like this draft season, he was a candidate to go number one overall, and he didn't have a great spring. I think he hit like 250, and if you're talking about a first round college hitter, those guys usually hit like 350, 400, but it's huge power. It's the kind of power the Guardians just don't have like anywhere in their organization. A few months ago, getting this guy at the end of the first round was like unthinkable. It was kind of like the shot they had to take, and they've kind of gone for power really with every pick, you know, beyond like the second round. It's like beyond my scope. I don't know too much about those kids, but I know they've gone hitter heavy, and you can't really draft for need, right? This is not like the NBA or the NFL where this guy's going to be on your roster next year. He's going to go into the minors for 2 or 3 years. And it's like, you don't know what's going to happen in 2 months. Predicting what you're going to need in 2 years is like impossible. But offense has been a challenge for the Guardians. It's been a challenge for several years now. And hitting the ball out of the park has been an issue. And you kind of look at even Chase DeLauder draft pick. They traded for Nolan Jones again because he can hit the ball out of the ballpark. It's something the Guardians need to do more. It's really hard to win games in 2025 without hitting the ball out of the park. So they're kind of gravitating that way. And whether it works out, I don't know. We're going to find out in a few years. But you can see the vision here, I think.
How do you feel about just the whole scouting staff for the Guardians at this point? I know it's just the beginning of the draft, but if you kind of look at them through the past couple years and trying to see what's, you know, made its way up to the bigs, I'm just wondering what the perspective is, because, you know, I think when ownership changed, they put a big emphasis on, we are going to put money into the minors. We're going to put money into the minors and make these guys come out and that they're going to be ready for the bigs. Now, just give me your overall perspective on, you know, the Guardians front office and where the scouting staff is.
Yeah, I know within baseball, Cleveland's very highly regarded for their player development, especially on the pitching side. Like pitching, they're one of the top organizations, and maybe we haven't seen it quite as much the last few years, but I don't go back to whatever got Shane Bieber. I think it was fourth round pick, and he was nothing like the guy he was, nothing like what he became in college. Like, that was a major development win for them. You see what Gavin Williams has become, what they've done with Slade Ciccone this year. That's player development. Player development is not always draft this guy, go through the minor. Sometimes it's scouting the other team's players, getting him, tweaking him, and turning him into something. So, yeah, the hitter development is not great. You know, that they have trouble just kind of getting guys to hit the ball with authority. You know, you do have Stephen Kwan eventually. Some of those guys kind of pop up. But the hitter development is, I wouldn't call it one of the best in the game, but it is highly regarded with people within baseball talking to them. It's just they have a lot of respect for Cleveland for always being in contention despite, you know, not having high payrolls. And they do that largely because they get their players to the big leagues. they scout really well other teams, and they make those players better that they get. So they're very highly regarded, even though I know it can be frustrating watching this team on the field like not be able to score a run during a 10-game losing streak. I know what that's like, and but they are, Jeff, I'm telling you, they're very highly regarded around the game.
What about when it comes to a power hitter? What's it been, Mike? Is it the philosophy of the team that they just go in a different way, bat to ball, you know, just trying to make contact, put the ball in play? Have they not been able to develop these kind of guys? Or you know,
yeah, I think it's obviously multiple factors, right? It's never one thing. I think they have put an emphasis on bat to ball ability. And they haven't had a ton of power in their organization. I think some guys that we've seen come up, whether it's John Kinsey Noel or Oscar Gonzalez a few years ago, like they showed power in the minors, but there was always some kind of swing and miss concerns there. They would chase a lot, and they came up, had that initial burst of success, and while that was happening, you kind of looked under the hood and said, I'm not sure how long this is going to last, and it didn't last for them. But I think it's a combination of just, okay, we aren't frustrating the bat-to-ball ability because – you just look at the game today, there's so many strikeouts. It's just really hard to get them back on the ball now. The pitching is just so good now. And they haven't had a ton of power in the minors. That hasn't been their priority. And that's clearly shifting now the last few years. And they're kind of taking the approach that, like, well, we're not going to be able to teach these guys to hit the ball out of the ballpark. We can maybe teach them to get the bat on the ball. So let's kind of, you know, kind of zig when we've been zagging for so long. But, yeah, there's definitely a priority there on just they've – first and foremost, get the bat on the ball. That's what we want our guys to do, with Kwan being like the main guy there. That's like the big development win for them. And so it's been prioritized bat and ball. We haven't had a ton of power hitters come up through the minors and kind of shifting now. But it looks like they are kind of prioritizing just the ability to get the ball out of the ballpark now.
You know, they had the 10-game losing streak. Then they came back. They won, what, 6 of their last 7. And in their last 2 losses, they came down to like 1 play in those games, and you know, a gigantic sweep over Houston to kind of set the tone going into the break here. They're sitting at 4.5 back. Are they buyers or sellers? And history to me makes me think that they don't go for it, but could they go for it?
Yeah, I think they're 4.5 back, but I think there's like 6 teams ahead of them in the wild card race. That's tough, you know, if you have to jump 2 or 3.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, I mean, the Royals are only a half game. They're even with the Royals. They're a half game behind the Angels, the Twins, and they're a full game back on the Rangers. I mean, in 2-3 days, they could, I mean, I'm being totally optimistic, right, they could jump into that spot behind the Rays.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just saying, when you have to jump that many teams, it's a lot. Because, like, you know, you have 6 teams ahead of you, 2 or 3 of them are going to win every night. You know, that's just the way it is. So, yeah. And I think that what we've seen in just the third wild card spot is really kind of taking some of the starch out of the trade deadline, because like nobody really wants to sell anymore. Every team thinks they're in it. You've seen a lot of teams kind of buy and sell at the same time, where they'll kind of ship somebody out, bring in somebody else to replace them. And I can see that maybe being a path for Cleveland, where maybe they don't go all in and buy, but they don't tear it down and sell either. I mean, I don't see a reason to do that. I think I'm not really even sure who they would move if they decide to trade somebody, but think are more likely to add than they are to subtract, and the additions they do make would be guys who are going to be around for a few years. You know, I don't think they're going to trade a bunch of prospects for rentals. That might not be the best idea, but I could see them moving players out to get somebody who could be around for 2 or 3 years for sure. I can't see them just kind of selling and kind of throwing in the towel. That's just something the Guardians never really do. They haven't done that in a very long time. And you look at the roster, I mean, I could see this team contending next year. I know the Tigers are set up pretty well, but 3 wild card spots, I mean, why can't they make a run for it next year? I think they're more likely to add than they are to subtract, for sure.
Mike Hexisa joining us from CBS Sports. Guardians actually added 2 more hitters from college in their first 2 picks here on day number 2. That makes me think about something that Andy and I talked about last week. You know, if you're going to move one guy and look for a haul in return, Emmanuel Clase might be the guy you could move if you're interested in moving your closer who's under great team control. But we thought you're going to move him for power hitting prospects, Mike, who are, you know, either close to major league ready or are here already. Well, they've just loaded up on that. That makes me wonder.
You just got to remember that the kids they're drafting today are multiple years away. If there's a chance to trade Class A for a major league outfielder who's ready right now, that's something worth pursuing. I wouldn't look at the draft having much impact on their deadline approach. And Class A would be, you know, because you do have the bullpen's really good. You know, you got Hunter Gaddis and Kate Smith. It's like if you trade Class A, you can. It's not like you're giving up in the late innings. You're still pretty well set there. And you know, teams always want bullpen help at the trade deadline. It's not like you put Class A out there with that contract. And even though he's not been quite as automatic this year as he was last year, there's going to be like a bidding war for him. And I think that would be the guy to move if you really want to get something significant in return. If you really want to add a young player to the offense who's going to move the needle for you and not just be like a new number seven hitter, Class A would be the guy to move. And, you know, would it be unpopular? Yeah. Would it be in the best interest of the team? Sure. You know, they're not going to trade Jose Ramirez, nor should they. And Class A is kind of your next bet to kind of really make a difference there. You know, Guardians are so good with pitching, whether it's promoting from within, finding guys in other organizations that they could survive that hits the bullpen moving forward. And that's something I would at least explore. I definitely wouldn't say no. If you got to at least listen, right? If teams call you, ask about Emmanuel Class A, you're this far out of the postseason spot with that many teams ahead, you got to at least listen. And yeah, I could see a situation where they trade Class A for somebody they could put in their lineup right away, not necessarily single A kids who are 3 years away from the big leagues. That would really surprise me if they just trade them for prospects.
Mike, last question. I saw you had a story on it too. It was something that definitely caught my eye as and Guardians / Indians fans. Terry Francona getting his 2000th win. Just your thoughts and reflections on him becoming just the 13th manager to do that in MLB history.
You know, it surprised me because I thought he got there already. I'm kind of surprised he's been, because he's been around for so long and he had so much success, especially once he got to Boston and then to Cleveland. His teams are always good. And, you know, I was surprised he came back this year because of the health issues. And so I'm just, you know, good for him, you know, finally just getting there. 2,000 managers, only 2,000 wins, only 13 managers have gotten there. He's going to be a Hall of Famer with like, there's going to be like no opposition to that, right? As soon as he's eligible, he'll sail in. And, you know, baseball doesn't have many really great like characters anymore, you know, and but he's certainly one of them. So I was happy to see him come back and just kind of like, you know, breathe, kind of be a breath of fresh air amongst these managers who, you know, you listen to them talk and there's just like nothing interesting coming out of their mouths now. And he's certainly a bit of a throwback in that regard. So congratulations to him.
That's a great point.
Mike, thank you very much. Thanks, as always, Mike. We really appreciate your time and your expertise.